Our first reading this morning is one of those stories as told in the Gospels of Mark and John. We'll start with Mark chapter 16. When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of James and Salome brought spices that they might go and anoint him. And very early on the first day of the week, when the sun had risen, they went to the tomb. They had been saying to one another, "Who will roll away the stone for us from the entrance to the tomb?" When they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had already been rolled back. As they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe, sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. But he said to them, "Do not be alarmed. You are looking for Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He has been raised. He is not here. Look, there is the place they laid him. But go, tell his disciples and Peter that he is going ahead of you to Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you." So they went out and fled from the tomb, for terror and amazement had seized them, and they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. Now from the book of John. But Mary stood weeping outside the tomb. As she wept, she bent over to look into the tomb, and she saw two angels in white sitting where the body of Jesus had been lying, one at the head and the other at the feet. They said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping?" She said to them, "They have taken away my Lord, and I do not know where they have laid him." When she had said this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there, but she did not know that it was Jesus. Jesus said to her, "Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you looking for?" Supposing him to be the gardener, she said to him, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have laid him, and I will take him away." Jesus said to her, "Mary." She turned and said to him in Hebrew, "Rabuni," which means teacher. Jesus said to her, "Do not hold on to me, because I am not yet ascended to the Father. But go to my brothers and say to them, 'I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God.'" Mary Magdalene went and announced to the disciples, "I have seen the Lord." And she told them that he had said these things to her. And back to the book of Mark. After this, he appeared in another form to two of them as they were walking into the country. And they went back and told the rest, but they did not believe him. Later, he appeared to the 11 themselves as they were sitting at the table, and he upbraided them for their lack of faith and stubbornness, because they had not believed those who saw him after he had risen. And he said to them, "Go into all the world and proclaim the good news to the whole creation."
The story of Jesus' resurrection is the miraculous story to crown all of the rest of the miraculous stories of his life. This story tells us that he rose from the dead and interacted with those with whom he'd been close, just as he had told them he would. They went to the tomb in grief and despair for the loss of their friend and teacher, resigned to the task of preparing his dead body for its final rest. They got there, and the stone had been rolled away, and Jesus was gone. The Gospel of Mark reports that the arisen Jesus had gone ahead to Galilee and would meet the disciples there, and that they didn't believe their own eyes when they met up with him. This was a final challenge for Jesus, as the disciples had been depicted by Mark throughout as being a little slow to follow Jesus' stories during his ministry. And Mark actually reports several instances of frustration with them on Jesus' part. Regardless, just as he had entrusted them with his message before his death, he now tasks them with proclaiming the good news to the whole creation. So despite them being the imperfect humans that they are, he tasks them with the crucial life-giving work of spreading the joy of love's saving power. The Gospel of John recounts the interaction of Mary Magdalene with Jesus after she finds the stone rolled away and the tomb empty. And according to this version of the story, she's the first to witness the miracle. She doesn't recognize him at first. I can imagine that the unexpectedness of his appearance, walking and talking, might have thrown her just a little bit. But once she sees the truth of his presence, she is moved from despair to joy. And Jesus instructs her to tell the disciples of his resurrection and ascension to help spread the joy and wonder she has experienced. This movement from despair to amazement to joy in both of these versions is the crux of the resurrection story for me. The message is consistent with other stories of transformation scriptures and their interpretations. The book of Exodus reports that the Israelites don't get to feel the joy of living in freedom until after escaping from slavery in Egypt. Liberation theologies, many of which are based on the Exodus story and the Jesus stories, privilege the perspectives of the poor and the oppressed, interpreting Jesus' message as a call to action born out of hopelessness and despair that will lead to freedom. Earth-based religions understand the rebirth that happens in the spring is only possible after the death that happens in the winter, and often use this as a metaphor for human awakening. Jesus had to die before he could be reborn. And his disciples' ideas of what is possible have to die before they can authentically proclaim the truth of love's power. The resurrection teaches them to see with new eyes, to perceive the power of love and hope being born out of despair. The story of the Apostle Paul is one of seeing with new eyes as well, literally as well as metaphorically. Paul, once a persecutor of early Christians, becomes a follower of Jesus after a conversion experience that first blinds him and then lifts the scales from his eyes. He begins to preach the good news himself and becomes Christianity's first and most influential evangelist. The ministers and theologians Rita Nakashima Brock and Rebecca Parker learned recently that the early Christian church buildings were decorated with scenes of what paradise on earth might look like, along with images frames of telling a story, you know, like a graphic novel. Images of the empty tomb, but not the crucifixion itself in these. I quote heavily here from an article they wrote in the summer 2008 issue of the UU World magazine. They project from this discovery about all these images that the focus of early Christianity was on living out the good news of Jesus' message and not on the salvation bought by Jesus' sacrifice. Paradise, they write in the early church, first and foremost was this world, permeated and blessed by the Spirit of God. And this was their first step, leading to their conclusion that Jesus' teachings and the practices of the early church affirmed life in this world as the place of salvation. The point of Christianity was to learn to see with new eyes, to see that paradise was here on earth, that, quote, sin had once closed its portals, but Jesus Christ had reopened them for the living. Images of crucifixion didn't appear in churches until 1,000 years after Jesus' life, when the Holy Roman Emperor Charlemagne violently converted the Saxons to Christianity. These victims of conversion started producing religious art that depicted violence in Jesus' death. Atonement theology was also born out of this time, the idea that Jesus' death was redemptive of human sin and became the passageway to salvation. The Reverend Doctors Brock and Parker call for a return to paradise on earth, writing that rediscovering paradise and recommitting ourselves to the ethics of paradise is what we need now. Western culture needs to stand again at the open doors of paradise and find its way to re-enter this world as a sacred site, as holy ground. Mary Magdalene and the disciples and Paul all witnessed events that allowed them this conversion to see with new eyes, to move from a place of despair to a place of joy, and to move that joy out into the world, into a building of faith that saw the world as spirit-infused paradise. What do we need to witness to move from despair to joy in today's broken world?
The Great Turning by Christine Fry. You've asked me to tell you of the Great Turning, of how we saved the world from disaster. The answer is both simple and complex. We turned. For hundreds of years, we had turned away as life on Earth grew more precarious. We turned away from the homeless men on the streets, the stench from the river, the children orphaned in Iraq, the mothers dying of AIDS in Africa. We turned away because that's what we had been taught. To turn away from our pain, from the hurt in another's eyes, from the drunken father, from the friend betrayed. Always we were told in actions louder than words to turn away, turn away. And so we became a lonely people, caught up in a world moving too quickly, too mindlessly, toward its own demise. Until it seemed like there was no safe space to turn, no place, inside or out, that did not remind us of fear or terror, despair and loss, anger and grief. Yet, on one of those days, someone did turn to face the pain, turn to face the stranger, turn to look at the smoldering world and the hatred seething in too many eyes, turned to face himself, herself. And then another turned, and another. And as they wept, they took each other's hands, until whole groups of people were turning. Young and old, gay and straight, people of all colors, all nations, all religions. Turning not only to the pain and hurt, but to the beauty, gratitude and love, turning to one another with forgiveness and a longing for peace in their hearts. At first, the turning made people dizzy, even silly. There were people standing to the side, gawking, criticizing, trying to knock the turners down. But the people turning kept getting up, kept helping one another to their feet. Their laughter and kindness brought others into the turning circle until even the naysayers began to smile and sway. As the people turned, they began to spin, reweaving the web of life, mending the shocking tears, knitting it back together with the colors of the earth, sewing on tiny mirrors so the beauty of each person, each creature, each plant, each life might be seen and respected. And as the people turned, as they spun like the earth through the universe, the web wrapped around them like a soft baby blanket, making it clear all were loved, nothing separate. As this love reached into every crack and crevice, the people began to wake and wonder, to breathe and give thanks, to celebrate together. and so the world was saved, but only as long as you too, sweet one, remember to turn.
I like that story. Joanna Macy is a Buddhist, an eco-feminist, an eco-philosopher, author, and activist. She coined the phrase, the Great Turning, to describe a cultural shift that she perceives is beginning to happen. The shift from what she calls the industrial growth society to the life-sustaining society. The Great Turning is nothing less than the political, economic, social, and spiritual challenge of this place and time. It's a revolution as big in scope as the agricultural and industrial revolutions, except that in order for it to work before we humans make our planet unfit for our own habitation, it has to be conscious. It has to be a lot faster. The central idea of the Great Turning is that we can build a society together that is life-sustaining in place of the one in which the growth of profit trumps the growth of health, fertility, and creativity. The central method of the Great Turning is what Dr. Macy calls the work that reconnects. We explored some of the aspects of that work last week when we talked about gratitude and pain. I shared the understanding last week that the industrial growth society forces us into consumerism, which leads us to view our earth as a commodity. It forces us into division, into haves and have-nots. It forces us to see some of earth's creatures as superior to others, to see humans as having more of a right to be here than other animals. And it forces us to divide further and see some humans as having more of a right to goods and services and justice than others. And I talked about how gratitude helps us to see that we do have enough, that we don't have to buy into being part of the industrial growth society. I talked about the pain that comes for me from having been complicit with systems of natural resource extraction in order to make a living, and from being complicit with institutional systems that do harm to some beings in order to benefit others. And there's other pain, too. I've been traveling a lot lately, most often by plane, and have had two recent experiences of feeling pain for our Earth and its people while looking out those little windows on planes. The first was on the ground at O'Hare Airport. While my plane was taxiing, I looked back toward the terminal and was overcome by the sight of all those planes standing and taxiing around and the distortion created by all the fumes that they were emitting. The planes themselves made me think of ants, kind of, marching along a path. But the feeling I had wasn't the one of wonder that I experience when seeing the miracle of communication and common purpose by those tiny little ants. The feeling I had was a pain in my heart at the pollution I was seeing for the atmosphere of our planet and for the people working on the tarmac and for all the beings living in the streams and on the land nearby. The second painful sight was up in the air. I have a deep sense of place, to connection to the earth. And I love to look down onto the earth when I fly, to see the landforms and the watersheds, the patterns, both natural and human-made. It used to be, when I flew, maybe 20, 30 years ago, that I could look way out into the horizon, right, and see everything so clearly. I notice now that's no longer true. No matter where I fly over the U.S., and over the last few years, I've flown northeast and southwest and north, pretty much all over. I can no longer see to the horizon for the haze, regardless of season, regardless of anything. And that's just in the U.S., where we have air quality regulations. A colleague told me recently about her trip to India, where she couldn't see the big red Sheraton sign on top of her hotel until she got within a few hundred feet of it. I've learned from Dr. Macy that honoring our pain for the world is a crucial step in this work that reconnects. In a society where we're encouraged to ignore or medicate or just get over our fear or pain, it's both crucial and revolutionary to acknowledge it and what it can teach us. So I'd like to share these words that I received from Commit to Respond's resource team this morning. And for those of you who don't know, Commit to Respond is the Unitarian Universalist-wide awareness-raising activity of Climate Justice Month this month. These are what I received. Being truly honest about the crisis we are facing returns us to our deep love for this world, for love is at the root of our sense of loss. Today, we reconnect with that love and remember why we entered this process, because we love and are inextricably interconnected with all the beings of this earth and the earth itself. Hope lives in these connections. By reaching out to reconnect with our community, our neighbors, and our allies in this struggle to reclaim life for all, we resource our souls for the work ahead. Reaching out reconnects us to our own well of inspiration and to relationships that make us resilient. We know power is everywhere and can be used for good or ill. The power of human connection can strengthen us, but power is not evenly distributed in our society. We carry this awareness in our connections and commit to an awareness of our own power in relationship, the power of others, and different patterns of power in society, and we choose to source our work with power that nourishes and works for justice, power that serves solidarity, and work against power that harms some and privileges others. And so I'd like to end by inviting you into an activity that can demonstrate this power. I'm going to ask you, as you're comfortable, in a moment, after I explain the activity, to pair up with a partner, if you're comfortable. And this is a physical activity. And Sarah, I didn't forewarn you, but I hope you'll help me demonstrate. So, what I'm going to ask you to do is one person at a time to flex your big arm muscle, and for your partner to grab hold of your arm there and try to pull it down. Both hands is fine. Try to pull it down and see what that feels like for both of you. Once you've done that, I invite you to stretch your arm out and have your partner pull again while you're stretching, as if you're reaching out, and see how that feels different. And then switch. So if you're comfortable, go ahead and do that. Come on up. Pick a partner. How many of you noticed a difference between pushing down on your partner's arm while they were reaching out and while they were flexing their muscle? Was one easier than the other? Which was easier? It was easier to push their arm down like this. Now the other way around for some of us. So it didn't all go the way it was supposed to for everyone. How about as the person reaching, as the person flexing and reaching, was it easier to resist the push down in either position? This. Yeah, so we're split. I should have known better. Do you want me to tell you the point? The point of the exercise is that we're actually stronger when we're reaching out. That it's harder to push down when we are reaching out and connecting to each other. It's a metaphor. The work that reconnects is the good news of our time. Engaging in it on a societal level will uncover something amazing within the human spirit, something that will help us build a society based on our connections, on our reaching out, and that will sustain life on our planet. Our separateness from each other is a delusion created by the industrial growth society to keep us dissatisfied, so we buy into the idea of ever-increasing growth, ever-increasing inequity, ever-increasing resource extraction. We know better. Joanna Macy says that we are born for this time. May it be so. May we be so.